to the Hot Hoops Podcast. I'm your host, Ernest Christian, alongside, of course, my my sidekick, David Mill. Dave, what's going on, man?
How you doing, Ernest? I'm doing pretty good.
It's over. The season's over.
It is.
Not sad, though. I'm not sad. I mean, if you compare to last year's conclusion, obviously it's a way two different sides of the spectrum, you know, in terms of the how the season's end. At least this year, you know, the Heat make the playoffs. They win a round, almost get to the conference finals, and when you're given the circumstances, of course, how everything happened over the course of the season, this is definitely a successful year for the Miami Heat.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of gracious reaction from Heat fans all over the place, but I got to be honest with you, I'm a little disappointed. I think, you know, for them to have come back the way they did and have such a big win in Game 6 and for them to have lost the way they did in Game 7, this was not the best version of the team that I wanted to remember on the way out. If it had been a close game where maybe Toronto got the edge because, you know, they were at home and they were playing their best version of that Raptors team, maybe it would have been a little different. But Miami fell flat in Game 7, and it was just disappointing overall. And I guess, yes, coldly or just, you know, flatly, you can state that the Heat season was successful, but that doesn't change the fact that I feel very disappointed in how it ended.
Oh, no doubt. You can, and I think really when we break this down, honestly, you can have both. It could be both. It could be, yeah, we're disappointed the way Game 7 played out, especially given the way the series played out in general. I mean, the series was nip and tuck the entire way from Games 1 through 6, you know? And then to see Game 7, you know, happen the way it did. I mean, I don't think the game was as bad as that score indicated. I think, because obviously the game was close even into the third quarter, and then Toronto pulls away in the middle of the third quarter. But I think what happened in Game 7, especially, too, for the Miami Heat, it was the fact that You have so many things that came into play here. You know, the injuries. And I think what was not being spoken about in this series more than anything else, the travel schedule was brutal on both teams, really. But especially for Miami, too, because having to play more games in their house than the other way around. I think that actually had a lot to do with the how flat they looked in the second half of that game. I just think at that point, I had nothing to give at that point.
I mean, it's... To me, this is almost as moot a point as the officiating. There's not much you can do about it. And the reality is that they were without their starting center, too. I know we were without Bosch for the last few months, but we had Joe Johnson, a noted Raptors killer in the past, and that should have been more of a factor there. But just everybody played poorly, I think. To be honest with you, I'm not making any excuses.
I agree. I
don't think you are either, but, I mean, to say that there's... You know, to say that there was travel problems, well, their series went seven games against Indiana, too. And we played seven against Charlotte, and, you know, they were there every game against Miami. So, I mean, that's not – to me, it's not much of a factor. I think maybe you look at it from the perspective of Miami, maybe they were older, so that travel maybe might have more of an impact. But then that's more about how you build a team and whether or not it was the right choice to bring a guy like – Joe Johnson, and then to bring somebody like Briante Weber instead of somebody with more size. I don't know. There's a lot of different factors there, but I don't know if they're, I don't know if they are mutually exclusive or not, but I don't feel, I mean, I guess it was a successful year, but I don't know. I can't shake this feeling of disappointment, to be honest with you.
I think right now we're still not even 24 hours, removed from, as of recording anyway. We're not even a full 24 hours of the game being over. I mean, it's fresh on our minds. The first thing to think about, of course, the end result's always the one you always used, out the gate. But and I agree with you. Disappointment also too. I'll tell you what. Going to Game 7, I mean, people ask me, you know, with predictions, you know, what's going to happen in Game 7 and all that. I thought they could win this game, but I also did not expect it because all those things I said, I had the same thoughts going to Game 7 that. The travel schedule, you know, like I said, the injuries, it is so much to overcome. And look, Dave, you sold me on this a long time ago. Toronto's a very good team. This is a team that won 56 games this year. Lest we forget.
I know. I mean, are you a convert now? Or do you believe in Toronto's chances?
No, I'm not a full convert. I've always said they're a good team, you know.
Yeah.
But look at how everything played out. Everything, to this point now. And look. Obviously, character. They build character on the way through. They learn how to win games when they need to win them. But, dude, they don't win easy. Like they have to sweat it. They have to sweat it. Even in Game 3, even in Game 7 yesterday, when Miami went down, in the third quarter. They still came back before the fourth and went down by six going, you know, late in the third quarter.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like I said, I think at that point it was just too much to overcome. But to me, this series was really lost at game three. To me, and look, I did say before game two was huge, but the thing is, when you go to Toronto, the goal is to take one of two. They could have taken both games to Toronto. And look, if they win those games in Toronto, games one and two, this series probably doesn't even go five games. Because you go to Miami, up 2-0, the confidence is shot for the Raptors, all that. But to me, ultimately, this series was lost in game three when they had a chance to, you know, take control of the series, you know, and get and mentally, you know, disable the Raptors. Yes, Whiteside, losing Whiteside hurt, obviously. But like I said, it was a wash because of Valanciunas being out. You know what I'm saying? But to me, the momentum switch was at game three. I don't think Miami got enough footing in the series after that.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I mean, that one hurt most, I think. You know, you go back, and then from that point forward, if you take game three, you're up, and it's the other team that's playing from behind as opposed to, maybe it would have gone seven games, but you still would have had a little bit of an advantage there, I think, and it would have made more of a difference. I mean, look, I think it was Luol Deng who said it. This is why you get home court in the first place. You want a game seven to be in your home court. And it didn't happen that way for Miami. And you know, we saw the difference against Charlotte. Maybe the Hornets probably are not as good a team as the Raptors, especially at this point in the season when they were facing as many injuries as they were. But, you know, Miami was able to have such a strong performance in game seven of that opening round. And then, you know, they fell flat against Toronto. So certainly home court had a big part to do with it as well.
One of the good things about the series, though, is seeing the And not for us, because we see this guy every day, you know. So his greatness is not questioned by us. But there was this national resurgence, and I said this on my other podcast recently, you know. And this is all of a sudden now the last like couple weeks, especially the last since the Charlotte series, this is like national remembrance of Dwayne Wade's greatness. All of a sudden now, the mainstream NBA fan may have forgotten how good this guy is. That was cool to people just realize, oh, crap, Wade is still pretty good. And that was one of the coolest things, I think, of this whole playoff run, to be honest with you, was seeing the reemergence, the rebirth of the Dwayne Wade narrative on the national scale, for me anyway.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. I think, you know, even seeing him as regularly, I think I'd forgotten how dominant he could be at times. You know, we've seen him as he's aged. You know, be less explosive at times, obviously, you know, rely more on the old man game, maybe exerting himself a little bit less on defense, even though he's always been a very good shot blocker, especially at his size. So that's always been a given. But he hasn't always played with a full engagement. And, you know, maybe that's just him being, at this point in his career, smart about when to exert energy, that he can't do it every game because he's 34 years old, so he's no longer able to do it on a daily basis. So but in the playoffs, he just took that game to a higher level. And it was a reminder even for me, not just at the national level. And I wrote about it, and you know, seeing him do the things that we've expected him to do was definitely an eye-opener and great to see, because he is still a very, very, very good player. And I think a lot of people had forgotten that.
Yeah, the last great Wade year that we had really was probably 2011. Like the last, like, elite Dwayne Wade, I think that the entire world really recognized was 2011 when they lost to Dallas, you know, because by then, by year two of the Big Three era, it was LeBron's team. By then, it was LeBron fully, you know, taking the mantle and being the guy, you know. And then,
yes,
you know, even last year when the Heat missed the playoffs, Wade was really good down the stretch. He had a good year last year, but it was so many, the roster was so disjointed at that point, though, that you couldn't get over that fact. So it was fun this year to see just the national recognition of Dwayne Wade and really people remembering, oh, wait, you know, this is a former Finals MVP. You know, this is the guy who at one point we were talking about as a top three or four player in the league, you know, even into 2011, you know. So it was good to see that, you know, people still remember, you know, Dwayne Wade as you know, and I'm sure people know Wade is good, but I just think on this, you know, just being at that level again, you know, at least nationally.
Right. No, absolutely. I agree with you 100%.
All right. So, obviously, season's over, series over, back to the drawing board. I think, personally, the Miami Heat, and I'm not being biased here because, you know, people say I'm being biased, but I'm not. But I think the Miami Heat, to me, are the most interesting team entering this free agency period. Now, obviously, the period does not start for another few weeks because there's still a conference finals to be played that the Heat are not a part of, but we're going to watch anyway regardless because we're basketball fans first anyway. And there's still the NBA finals to happen in June. But, of course, right after the finals ends, we're boom, right in the head, hit with the draft and hit with free agency. So we're not far away from that happening. And the Heat, I believe, have, what, 9 free agents going into this process? Am I correct in that number? Is it 9, 8 or 9?
Yeah, I haven't done an exact figure, but I think you're right, though. I guess off the top of my head, I can think of it. And yeah, it's probably 9.
Yeah, I mean, Dwayne Wade, Luol Deng, Hassan Whiteside, even Josh Richardson is a non-guaranteed guy. He'll be back next year. I might worry about that necessarily. Joe Johnson, Udonis Haslam, Amari Stoudemire. Am I missing anybody else? Oh, Tyler Johnson is restricted, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of question marks heading into the free agency period. Before we get there, I know people want to talk about that because that's a hot topic for Heat fans now. Before we get there, let's put a bow on the season. I want to grade each player on their performance during the season and the playoffs, and give a little analysis on that moving forward, obviously. But I want to grade each player on this roster and give your opinion on that. So let's go start. All right. Let's start with the starters real quick. And I think this one right off the bat is going to be one of the more meatier stories. Meatier, I mean, in terms of like, you know, this interesting. Goran Dragic, obviously. He was the free agency prize last year for the Miami Heat. Dragic this season. I mean, how would you put it in a nutshell? How would you grade it?
How would I grade his season? I think that there was an adjustment period. I think that he had moments of greatness. I think that people expected him to be dominant because of the type of salary that he was earning. But I don't think that's his role on the team to be dominant. He's not Russell Westbrook. It's a completely different game. He's not going to fill the stat line. Not to say that that's what Westbrook does. I love Russ's game. But, you know, they rely on him to provide more, to produce more in Oklahoma City than what Goran's role is in Miami. So if I was giving him a grade, I would say it was a B. I think there's room for growth there. I think that there was still a solid performance overall. It's not difficult. It's not easy to take a team away from Dwayne Wade and to kind of assert yourself the way that you had to do, the way we saw in specific moments during the playoffs. So if you were asking me, I'd grade his season at about a B.
I gave him a B minus, actually. I almost went C, but I think some of the moments he had in the playoffs, especially in game 6 and 7 of the first round series against Charlotte, kind of really reminds you of what he can do when he's engaged and when he's actually given the opportunity to be, you know, be able to carry the team. Obviously, obviously the first half of the year it was tough because, you know, adjusting to the philosophy, you know, and you had Chris Bosh here, and you know Dwayne, sure. Chris Bosh, you can tell, did not necessarily want to be running, you know, up and down the court, you know, every single game. They're a little older, obviously.
Wade gets a lot of crap for being, you know, sometimes holding the ball a little bit too much and then creating an offense that way. But Chris does the same thing. You know, he gets the ball at the top of the post and he holds it a little bit. You know, he's a good facilitator, obviously not as good as Wade and certainly not as good as Dragic, but he holds the ball. He makes his move. He'll unleash the jumper or he'll try to drive past a bigger, slower opponent. So when you're looking at why Goran Dragic started playing better during the second half of the season, almost invariably have to look at the fact that there was no Chris Bosh in the lineup and that Joe Johnson is able, even at his age, to move a little bit more quickly and you know, get down the court a little bit, you know, more quickly than Chris Bosh or Dwayne Wade is at this point. So, you know, I think that's why Goran had such a strong second half and that's why he was able to assert himself a little bit more in the playoffs as well.
And furthermore, too, I think Goran got a lot of blame from fans, from people who did not understand the process, who didn't understand, you know, you know, a lot of the reason why he wasn't productive in the first half of the year was not his fault. It was the philosophy and figuring out the pieces. That's all it was.
Yeah, it's difficult. And I think, you know, like I said, the contract certainly created a lot of expectations. People were expecting him to all of a sudden be this incredible MVP type of player. I mean, that's not the strength of his game. And maybe he was struggling a little bit shooting wise, and maybe he wasn't as aggressive But certainly he did, you know, he played solidly at the first half of the season. But the fact that he was able to go to another higher level in the second half of the year, hence particularly in the playoffs, for me is what strengthened the overall grade. Yeah, there were struggles, but he got past them, and that's what you want to see. And it's the first year of 5 years. I still see people talking about trading him, and I think that's absolutely ludicrous. He's such a solid overall player. The fact that he's sacrificed teeth and blood and sweat
many times over
to help this team
many times over
in order to help. You know, how can you overlook that? You know, you think about Miami and the teams that Pat Riley created. They were rough and gritty, etc.
He's a Riley guy.
This is a guy who's sacked, you know, has given up teeth and done as much as he possibly could. I don't know what it is. I don't know if there's a little reverse racism here or because he's European. Whoa. There's a stigma attached to it.
Whoa, I like that. Reverse racism. Okay.
Isn't it entirely possible? I mean, look, seriously.
You never know.
I mean, you expect players to be a certain way, and especially in the NBA, and maybe because he's European. Maybe not necessarily because he's white or whatever. Not that it's a big deal one way or the other. But, you know, maybe you expect him – maybe you don't think he's as quick. You know, you saw guys like Kemba Walker be able to get past him in the first round of the playoffs. I don't know. I'm not quite sure what – I can't put my finger on it because it's not a way I feel at all, and I think certainly you don't either. I think we both appreciate Dragic's contribution.
I'm a Dragic guy. I'm pro Dragic. And by the way, I thought he played well defensively in this Toronto series against Kyle Lowry, all considering.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe there was some familiarity there like we talked about because they had played together in Houston, so they certainly knew each other. There was no animosity there. It wasn't like Kemba Walker or Jeremy Lin throwing their head back every time there was contact there. You know, both players tried to push through it, and they exploited weaknesses in each other's defense, and that's how they were able to score and produce. But I think, you know, Dragic had a great year overall, and he could have been better. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the bar is set so high when you get a guy like Steph Curry and Golden State, so... but that's not who Goran Dragic is. That's not the expectation for him. It shouldn't be. So if that's what you expected at the start of the year, forget about it. What he's going to be is a guy who's going to get you a bunch of assists. He's going to be able to push the pace. He's going to connect from the mid range. He's going to get to the hoop, and he's going to score at a high rate. That's about it.
What I like to see personally from Dragic going forward, and you saw moments of this in this series, in the Charlotte series, even throughout the year, once in a blue moon, but it's still shocking to me he's not this guy. I would love for him to develop that 3-point shot.
Absolutely,
and he said himself actually that the reason why it never happened is because growing up playing ball overseas, you know, he was known and always wanted to go to the basket, and that was the game he learned, and he never really thought to himself to develop a 3-point shot because the game he was raised on wasn't necessarily a perimeter game. So, but I would love, but he can be that guy. We've seen the moments in this series where there were games in this playoffs he hit three pointers in a game. So there's room for that. And I think. If he adds that to his game, I think honestly he'll make him 10 times more dangerous.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, look, we saw in the series with Toronto in particular when Miami was not shooting well, the floor spacing was a problem. And Dragic, you know, he's not an adequate floor spacer. He's okay, but he's not going to be a kind of guy that is going to draw the defense, especially at the perimeter. So you have to work on that. And when you have him and Wade, both of them notoriously poor shooters from the outside. I think that's an issue. So, I mean, yeah, you'd love to be able to see that from him. I think we will, actually. I think as he gets older now, he'll probably rely more on that outside shot. And like you pointed out, he's probably always had that quickness to be able to find a seam of the defense. That's the thing that I knew that coming in.
Right.
That's what something that Dragic provided. But seeing it now for a season and a half, he has that stutter step there where he just gets past somebody. He's not necessarily – as fast as a guy like Walker or John Wall or anything like that, but he just knows how to use his speed more precisely, more intelligently, and then he's able to get past the defender, and that's why he finishes at such a high rate at the rim.
Right. Okay. Next guy here, we're going to go to the franchise. The guy, you know, number three. 3-time champion, Dwayne Wade. I gave him an A. I just think this playoff run would have given him a B during the year because he was still good, but given the changes, and he was not only the changes the Heat went through throughout the year, the willingness. And look, we've seen, and people think it's so easy to change. We've seen other superstars not willing to change. Kobe Bryant's an example. You know, Dwayne Wade was willing to change for the betterment of the team. And then when they needed him to be the guy, he was the guy and got us to a game with a date with LeBron and the Cavaliers. So I gave him an A.
Yeah, kind of hard not to. I mean, and part of that, I now we see why, you know, some of these regular season awards are voted on so much earlier, because you're not influenced by playoff performances. And it's hard not to be when Wade was as dominant as he was at times. So, but still, overall, I'd say you're right. Like, I don't think you can change. I don't think you could say anything else other than having a great season. I mean, made the All-Star team. I know that's somewhat, not necessarily a strong indicator of how well he played, but he did play well. He made it through 74 games, or just, you know, almost 74 games. That was his barometer for the season. He wanted to play in that many games, and he did it. He's healthy. He's lighter than he has been in a few years. We saw some explosiveness from him. We saw him being able to change the course of a game, which to me has always been his strongest suit, is that there were very few players that can impact the game on both sides, and Dwayne Wade was one of them. And we saw a lot more of that in the postseason, and so to me, he definitely had an A game.
Yeah. He earned every dollar of that $20 million contract that he signed last summer. You know, 1 year, $20 million. It's going to be hard for Riley and company to go to Wade again and tell him, hey, Dwayne, great job this year. Can you take less again? It's going to be hard to tell him that. It really is.
Wow. I let's hold our thoughts on that until we talk more about free agency.
No, right. I'm just saying, he made a case to make it harder for the Heat to take less money this summer. And this playoff run definitely made it harder for, you know, for Riley and company to actually go that route. Not saying he won't help the team, obviously, but, you know, all the gripe from Heat fans in recent seasons about, oh, either Wade has to take less, or just trade him, or just get rid of him, or don't bring him back. I think, obviously, seeing what we've seen the last few weeks, I think that's died a slow death, to say that.
I think you're probably right. Yeah. I think you can make an argument that maybe during the regular season he wasn't as engaged, and you didn't see the very best version of him that you could see. And that's mostly what you're paying him that kind of money for. So I think you could still make that argument, though. I mean, maybe it's not as strong as it was at the start of the year when he had that huge salary, but It's tough. It's tough to gauge with Wade. So we'll save some more of that analysis for the free agency period.
Dwayne at this point in his career is a playoff performer. I think he even in a recent interview with Ethan Skolnick, or one of the beat writers, a couple of days ago, had clued in on that, saying that basically he looks forward more to the playoffs than the season. Like, the regular season means nothing to him. Let's get to the postseason and then I'll do my thing. And I think that's why you see, like, guys like even LeBron now take time off, you know, take the games off in the regular season. Wade's at that point now too, where he'll take games off. But the thing is, though, you can only do that if you have the right roster around you for guys to carry your load. You know, Kobe Bryant didn't have that last 3 years because, you know, so he couldn't do that. You know, LeBron has that ability to do that in Cleveland because he has other guys on that roster that can carry a load on you know, a game here, a game here. Dwayne had that this year too in Miami. So, yeah, so that's why I think he gets an A, though. I think obviously you pay him for the big bucks for the big money time, and he was big money in it when you need to be big money. And once again, a game away from the conference finals, like I said, overachieved this year. Okay, next guy here, Luol Deng, one of our favorites. You and I love this guy.
He's a great player. Had some strong moments against Charlotte in particular. Played good defense in the Toronto series, although he was not as productive offensively, so that certainly sours his overall postseason performance. But as far as his regular season numbers, up and down, but you do have to give credit for him being able to step up into the power forward role, and that certainly changes things a lot. So it's kind of incomplete. You know, you almost have to give him an incomplete grade because you didn't really see him maximized as far as what he's at this point in his career. You know, he's slower. He's not as good a defender as he once was, although he's still a solid overall perimeter defender. But I gave him a C+.
I went higher. I gave him a B+ because the change in the lineup, just throwing him into the power forward spot after the All-Star break when Bosch went down, okay? Being right. Great when he needed to be in the playoffs. I gave him a pass in the Toronto series because DeRon DeRozan was so great against Miami this year. Remember, he averaged 30. We discussed, you and I, how he's going to be a problem. And that was Deng's assignment the entire series. And I was okay with Deng not being as productive offensively because of the fact that all his energy was spent on DeRozan slowing him down. And for the most part, he did that. Now, obviously, DeRozan had, you know, a good game here or there, but for the most of the series, DeRozan struggled, and a lot of that was due to Dang in his defense. And Dang gets hurt, obviously, in game number 5, which slowed him down, obviously, at the back end. So, but the guy always showed up. The guy was, you know, a grinder, and he I mean, I think his value's gone a little bit more north now since the All-Star break. And I think, once again, when we get into the conversation of free agency, we're gonna have it's gonna be hard to keep this guy around, I think, given the salary cap. But we'll see what happens, though. But I thought Dang was he had to adjust a lot, you know, in these 2 years being Miami. You know, last year he's not used to being a guy on the perimeter, sitting on the perimeter and taking 3-point shots, and he did that. I mean, didn't work necessarily for the team, but still. So I think Dang, you know, adjusting what he needed to be for the sake of the team. And like I said, Riley, when they brought him here 2 years ago, the professionalism he brings to this franchise, it's still there.
Oh, sure. Sure.
So B+, definitely, for Luol Deng.
Okay. I mean, I could see it. I think, you know, the issue is overall what we saw from him, particularly last season, the inconsistency, that there was going to be games there where he's going to be productive, and there were going to be games there where he wasn't. And so that is, I think, some of the frustration that I've seen from Heat fans. And not until he stepped in at the power forward role did we see him play much more consistently, I think. And that just might be where he's at this point in his career, you know. It's just he's no longer the same athletic swingman that he was, and the league has changed. There's more small ball lineups, and I think he thrives in it. And it's a big question mark. He's shown – maybe he's added more value to himself as a free agent because he's shown that he can play more of the four spot. But then he's no longer going to be getting those big bucks as a small forward because that's just no longer his best role. I mean, it's not where he plays most productively. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with him this summer.
All right. Next guy here, Chris Bosh, obviously missed a good portion of the season due to the recurrence of the blood clots, of course. I'll tell you what, I'm grading this based on what he did do for the team when he was available. I gave him A-. And the reason I gave him A- is because of the fact that the team was not really that. The team was at the time before he had the blood clots. It was still struggling. It was still, you know, where is this team going to go? It was only 4 games over 500 at that point. And when you're the leader of the team, you're the best player, you have to bear some of that blame. So at the time, I'm grading based on what the time he played. That said, he had, individually speaking, he had a great bounce back year. And I thought he should have been a starter this year in the All-Star game, personally, but that's just me.
It's tough to say. I think, you know, Atlanta's backcourt there, or front court rather, with Millsap and Horford might have been a little bit more deserving. They were pretty good overall, and yeah, I don't know. It's tough to gauge that. But I go a little bit lower on his overall grade because I still think he was a B. He's not expected to be as dominant as a guy like LeBron or Kevin Durant or anybody like that. But you expected a little bit more from them. There were some struggles there at the start of the year. He needs to be a little bit more productive. And I know that's harder to do, especially because of the health concerns. But I think that's what you expect out of a guy like Chris Bosh. You need him to be able to, you know, space the floor better, to do a little bit more on defense. The capacity's there. We didn't always see that from him when he was in there at the start of the year. Great overall player, absolutely, and certainly a great overall person. I really do like Chris Bosh quite a bit, but I'd like to have seen him be a little bit more dominant, to be able to, you know, take over the game a little bit more, and I think he's capable of doing so. You know, I think it's tough to gauge this in retrospect because of the injury and how many games he did not play. But while he was in there, I'd say he was a B player.
Okay, that's not bad. I mean, but nearby, not wrong with that at all. Okay. All right, this is going to be really, I don't know if contentious, but we'll see here. Hassan Whiteside. Now, you and I have had debates on the Whiteside thing all year long in writing and on this podcast. I gave him an A- because the impact was there. When he was locked and engaged, he was dominant. He was dominant, really, to be honest with you, on both sides of the floor. And he did mature. I mean, obviously, you want him to be the perfect citizen. You know, you want to be like, you know, we obviously seen Alonzo Mourning years ago, be that guy, be the guy who's focusing and 100%. He's not there yet, but let's just say attitude-wise, Whiteside did not regress. If we're going to grade on a curve, Hassan Whiteside was better this year attitude-wise than he was last year. So you saw some of the positives, what he could bring to this team, you know, obviously on the court, but also hopefully when he gets paid, and if he stays in Miami, of course, what he could be. I mean, obviously there's some things you want him to mature on, but you know, for the most part, I thought he did a really good job of really trying to become better for the team as well. So I gave him an A- for that.
Okay. Yeah, I think you're grading people a little bit more highly than I was. I would say that for me, when I look at Whiteside's individual season, it was actually a tale of two different years. And I think, you know, the start of the season was a very different one for him. We expected bigger things from him. And yeah, the numbers were there as far as the blocks, but we didn't see the consistency from him. We didn't see the drive. So I rated the first half of his season as a C. And then the second post-Bosch, you know, part of the season, I'd give him an A for that, because I think that from that point forward, following the suspension, and maybe I'm making more out of it, although I think enough people close to the organization have hinted at it so that there might be some reality to it, I think he really did recognize that his behavior had consequences. And you say to yourself, how come he didn't notice before this? You know, he had to have known last season when he was ejected after getting into a fight with Alex Len, and then again with Kelly Olynyk. You know, that he should have understood that there were repercussions there. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe it's just, maybe he's slow on the uptake. Maybe he just didn't realize. Maybe he didn't understand how to control his temper. And maybe it's just a maturation process. But the point is that we saw it. You know, we did see that growth from him. And I think that that one game suspension was enough to really drive home the point. And I think we saw a much better version. We could have seen him lose his cool against Charlotte. We could have seen him do that against Toronto. And in both cases, we saw a different, better, and I think more stable version. And you know, it's not to say that he should be controlled or that he has to be a different person or anything like that. But the reality is he's more effective when he's in the game and engaged. And that's what you want to see. This isn't criticizing him as a person or anything like that. Neither of us know him well enough to say what he's like off the floor. But the reality is that he needs to be a better overall player, and part of that is being more focused and engaged, and we saw a better version of that in the second half. So for me, I give him a B overall because of the second start of the season.
All right. I like that. I think that's – you broke it down great and beautifully, actually, because tail two seasons. Before Bosch went down, you know, obviously, there was some moments where sometimes you wonder, okay, is this the end of the road here? But then I want – the reason I grade it so high is I want to reward – the turnaround. Okay, I recognize this. Bosch goes down. He's also not only that. Remember, Whiteside also went through the second half of the year on the bench behind Stoudemire, and he kept his mouth shut. You know, so
he accepted it gracefully. I think that was a huge thing from him.
Yeah, and that's why I was grading on. And he was still effective even when doing so. So I want to reward that. You know, the turnaround. So, but B's fine too. I'm definitely okay with that. Okay, good. Rookie, a first year guy, Rook One, Justice Winslow. I went B minus because of the offensive woes in terms of the outside shooting, whatnot, which I think will get better. I think he does show some flashes of a guy that could be a good shooter. You know, you do see, once in a while you do see that. You know, but defensively, of course, he's phenomenal. He already has the NBA body. He's 20 years old, only 20 years old, and the maturity, man. I mean, this is where he really getting value now. This guy played. He played significant minutes, of course, outside game three, which we'll talk about later on, man, what happened there. Which I actually did agree. I understood what Spo was doing in the moment, but you gotta play him when you get a chance. But I thought Winslow was a consummate professional all year long. He's definitely a Heat guy. He's definitely a Riley guy also. I believe he'll be here for a very long time. If he can get the shooting, you know, a little more consistent, obviously, going forward, He'll be a phenomenal player. But defensively, he's great. Defensively, playing Paul George, LeBron James, and playing elite guys and really hanging with them. I mean, not necessarily stopping them, but hanging with them as a rookie. I mean, I thought he did really good this year. But I gave him a B- only because of the offensive woes he showed at times.
Justice Winslow is so difficult for me because, as somebody on Twitter is constantly happy to point out to me, I was not fond of him at the start of the year, at the very start of the year. Like, you know, looking in a season previews, I thought that, you know, I was asked, you know, to make one crazy prediction, and my crazy prediction was that Justice Winslow would be a bust. And I've never made a bigger mistake, I think, in anything that I've ever said or written about basketball. That was clearly a big mistake. But part of that was gauging him in Summer League and seeing him up close and seeing him kind of indifferent. You know, that was the whole thing for me. Like you see Miami and the kind of energy that morning always displayed, and maybe it's different nowadays. And I don't think that's the case, but you know, to see Justice Winslow up close, there was almost like this feeling of, I didn't care. I don't really expect to do much anyway. It's only just Summer League. Why am I going to bust my hump? And you kind of want to see more from that, particularly from a rookie, that it might be, you know, a major cornerstone of the franchise moving forward. So to me, I saw that, and I was so concerned about his offensive problems that I thought he was just going to be wasn't going to pan out. Not as a great value at number 10, that he just wasn't going to be an impact player. And luckily, I was dead wrong about that. You know, his defense has been extraordinary. There was that streak there where went up against LeBron James, I think Kevin Durant, and then Paul George within a 4 or 5 game span, and he impacted all of them. Like, he harassed the heck out of all of them. He didn't shut them down, because those guys can't be shut down, let's be honest. But to harass them at some points, especially at 19 years old, it's just phenomenal. And I think there is a whole hell of a lot of potential there. And I think now, and somebody pointed out to me, it's like, you know, Tim Duncan is a reserve player. Are you going to say that he's not a great player? And you're absolutely right. Maybe Justice Winslow, maybe that's just his personality type. He's a little bit more reserved. Mm-hmm. But it's part of the maturation there, like you pointed out. And that's part of why I think he's going to fit in so well there. We've seen a lot of beat reporters talk about the maturation. It has to be a real thing. It's not just... it's not overblown. It's not just a narrative that they exaggerated for the sake of the press that, or for the public that loves him. I think he's just really able to handle and adjust. And look, he handled that benching in the playoff series against Toronto pretty well. He came out strong the very next game. He was productive offensively. I think that's a very good sign from him. And he was definitely a factor in many, many games this year. So grading him is difficult because the offense is so bad, but I think he's just been so impressive defensively. I might go a little higher, give him an A-.
I'm not wrong with that. And not only that, the flexibility he showed in this series, you know, when without Whiteside, of course, and, you know, the Heat going super small, you know, going death lineup, almost Golden State-like, in Game 6 and 7, you know, playing him at the center and him doing, you know, doing what he could to keep the season alive. And he actually played – he actually was very energetic and productive in these last two games, just for the record.
Yeah, I agree. Do you think the talk of comparing him to Draymond is a little overblown?
Yeah, it is overblown. I say that tongue-in-cheek because – this is, you know, I said on Twitter yesterday, you know, this is the Heat's version of the death lineup, you know, the Justice Winslow at center. But I will say this, though. I think Spo might have found something to use going forward.
Yeah, it's good to have somebody that can be that versatile and fit in there. And look, I don't know what they list him at. What did they list him at? Like 6'7", right? Isn't that the reality?
Say that again?
That his height, they list him at like 6'7" or so?
Yeah, I keep hearing that. He looks smaller than that, though.
He is. I'll tell you, I've stood next to him. He's not 6'7".
What is like, it, 6'4"?
At least 3 inches of that 6'7" are hair. And 6'4", is, I mean, he's really barely taller than I am. I go 6'2", 6'3". He's really just
tall?
A little bit taller. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well,
I'm only 5'8", so.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, I've stood next to him and directly next to him, so I know exactly how much taller he was. So, and this was at Summer League. He came in, happened to use the urinal in the men's room. So I know for a fact how tall he is because he was right next to it. So, yeah, this is an exaggeration whatsoever. And, you know, I've seen him in the locker room since then. But other than that, yeah, he is not. And that was with the hair. You know, that's, you know, there's a lot of hair up there. It's all kicked out and crazy. So he adds definitely a bunch of inches that way. But he's not 6'7". Not at all.
Okay, next guy here, Rook 2, Josh Richardson. I gave him a B+ because he overachieved. He did more than we thought, especially second half of the year. We talk about people who benefited from the second half of the year of Bosch going down, and I'm not saying Bosch going down was a great thing for the Heat because it wasn't, but at the same time, people did benefit from you know, the playing time and the opportunity to get the ball, and he's one of those guys, too, that benefited from that. I mean, I thought he'd be a good player, productive player, which is why they traded Mauro Chalmers out of there in November. But my God, after the All-Star break, he really turned things around and added that 3-point shot too. Especially, let's just right now, Miami did a great job. I mean, they got lucky with these rookies, the maturity of these rookies, and them playing key minutes and big minutes in the playoffs. And just the fact that these guys are that want to get better and whatnot. I mean, Miami's in a good place. I get this guy B plus, man. I thought he was phenomenal the second half of the year.
Yeah, I went higher. I think he's an A player. I mean, I can't say A plus because there were still struggles there. Mm-hmm. And
especially
he
in the playoffs too. Especially in the playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't much of a factor at the start of the year, but for him to build himself back up and to being a regular rotation player, that it took the injury to Tyler Johnson and Beno Udrih for us to even give him a chance. And now looking at him, there's potential star quality there, not just defensively where we saw him hound a guy, Kemba Walker, who's super fast and one of the quickest players in the NBA, and Josh Richardson was able to really get on into, you know, harass him completely and you know, not shut him down because, you know, Walker's a hell of a player. But Richardson was really a factor there. We saw him lose a little confidence in his offense, but I think with another season, we've already seen incredible work ethic from him. The story about how he developed that 3-point shot in the first place, you know, is certainly a great example of that. But we're gonna see continued growth from him. I think there's a great deal of potential there. I wasn't huge on him as a, you know, coming into the season. I didn't think he was going to be much of a factor, and I don't think anybody did. You know, but I was impressed that the team saw something in him early on. You know, I remember when they first drafted him, and I remember talking to our fearless editor, Suri, about this, the fact that they were selling Josh Richardson jerseys along with Justice Winslow jerseys in the team store. And I asked him, I go, isn't that kind of unusual for a second-round pick? Somebody who, you know, more than likely isn't going to be sticking around the team. And he's like, you know what? They see something in this kid. And sure enough, you know, he went from the D League and he built himself up to being, a stuck on the bench every game. And then, you know, he was able to chip in a little bit more here and there. I think we saw some great defense from him. And then once Beno went down, once Tyler went down, and he was able to get more minutes, he capitalized on that. And I think that's a huge part of what makes success in the NBA is seeing an opportunity and seizing it. And I think he did a phenomenal job, and that's why I give him the A.
And this is a credit to Eric Spoelstra, too, his great coaching. People think that coaching is only done on the sidelines. That three-point shooting was developed because of Eric Spoelstra staying on him and on him and on him for, you know, for months upon months throughout the year. You know, people, you know, and once again, it's narratives that I can't stand. You know, oh, Eric Spoelstra, you know, overcoaches. Yeah, he has his moments. He overcoaches, of course, but coaching also happens behind the scenes that we don't see on TV. And
sure,
Richardson became who he was, like Whiteside. Richardson became who he was because Eric Spoelstra staying on him and as his project. And the shooting was, I mean, obviously regressed to the mean by the playoffs, but the shooting was out of this world. I mean, he was like putting up Steph Curry numbers for a little while, for good, like 2-3 weeks, for a good while. So
yeah, Eastern Conference Rookie of the Month in March, and I think he led the league in 3-point percentage. I thought, wasn't he shooting like 45%?
Yeah, like Steph Curry like stuff, like that is, it's crazy. You know, so once again, that's a credit to the coaching staff here, and especially the head coach Eric Spoelstra. So once again, we already pro Spoelstra podcast. I don't care. Whatever. So. I guess I'm sick and tired of the anti-Spoelstra crowd. This annoys me. All right. Joe Johnson came in February off waivers from the Brooklyn Nets. This is going to be tough because I thought he was great in the time he was here up into the playoffs, and then it was very inconsistent. So it's hard to grade him. I'm going to give him a B- because he was kind of the reason we got to this point. I had a 3-seed in the Eastern Conference, losing Bosh. He was able to be not necessarily Bosh, but at least 70% of the production he that Bosh gave, at least a little bit to keep things stabilized. So I have to reward him there. But the playoff run, you know, he was way up and down. And obviously when Whiteside went down, we were hoping to have him step up a little more, and he really didn't do that much, really. So I had to give him a B- instead. But I'll give him credit for the fact that he was the reason that he got the 3-seed. One of the reasons why, because he was able to keep that everything, the ship afloat, if you will, for the Miami Heat.
He impressed me a lot. I accepted the narrative a little too easily that the version of him that we'd seen in Brooklyn, kind of languishing there the last couple of seasons, was the version we were going to get down him, that he wasn't going to be much of a factor. But the fact that he was able to come in and start and play heavy minutes, even at this point in his career with his age, and all the minutes that he's seen, was a huge, it made a huge impression on me. And you're right, he absolutely was a factor. So it's difficult to gauge him because he only played for a number of games for us. But I think he was a really solid player. I think he had his moments defensively. I know he certainly had some offensively. So I would say he's a B+.
Okay. Wow. You've been better than I did.
Yeah, I think he, you know, he really did impress me. I thought, you know, and that's a mistake on my part that I assumed he wasn't going to be much of a factor. I mean, you know, you saw teams like Cleveland, Oklahoma City, they were going to get a guy like Johnson in there, and you wonder how he could have fit in onto those, you know, lineups of those teams. He would have been stuck on the bench. A guy like you know, Channing Frye went over there, and he's basically just a guy that they bring off the bench every once in a while. You know, in Oklahoma City, he probably wouldn't have started at the two spot, and he certainly wasn't going to supplant Kevin Durant at small forward. So you wonder where he would have fit in. But, you know, this was an ideal situation for him. Again, an unfortunate consequence of losing Chris Bosh is that it opened up a lot of opportunities for a lot of players, and the team capitalized in so many different ways. I mean, Dragic played better. Richardson played better. Whiteside played better. Joe Johnson got a chance. Richardson got his chance. You know, Justice Winslow, Luol Deng played a better role. So much fell into place as a result of Chris Bosh's injury, and it really worked out for Miami. So that's a strong end of the season.
I think I can see him, and I hope he embraces this idea. If not Miami, somewhere else. But I think he could be a very effective six man moving forward.
Yeah, I don't see why not. I think maybe it's tough to stay with him because I think he's more of a, you know, he needs to get into a little bit of more of a flow or so. And I think that he needs kind of to start and get that rhythm going. And I'm not sure that he has the speed or agility to just go in there and dominate a second lineup. It's tough to say. It could happen for him, but you know, we haven't seen him in that role, so I'm not sure how to project it. But I think he needs a little bit to feel. I think he needs to feel the rhythm of the game, and I think he does so better as a starter. Even if you just kind of cut his minutes early on and bring somebody in for him, I think it helps him feel more of the flow of the game. And he's not going to be that kind of instant offense that you like in a six man. And unfortunately, as we saw in the postseason, his defense is not nearly as great as it once was. So, by the way, I want to go back here. As far as Richardson's numbers, he shot 50% in February and 59% in March. Ridiculous. I mean, what a boost from him from 3-point range. Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Spoelstra, the same. All right. Josh McRoberts, a.k.a. McBob. Oh, this is going to be a tough one. I will give him credit for this one. He was productive in the series when he had to be. When the Heat lost Whiteside for the series, McBob was very productive. He scored double figures the last two games, too, on top of that. But overall, the narratives, it's tough to go away from the narratives here because the availability, number one, wasn't available. He was injury-prone, obviously. We can say it and not, you know, this is tough, but this has been a very disappointing stint so far for McRoberts here in Miami in these 2 years. I'm going to give him a D. I wanted to go C minus, but I just think we have to address what is it is. I mean, this has been a very disappointing 2 years of McRoberts now. And he tends to get very, and now look, he was very aggressive in this series, so I'll credit him there. But I think what, and I know he's more of a facilitator, but I just wish he was a little more aggressive offensively, even just a little bit. And sometimes he's not, and it actually hurts the team a lot of ways too. I mean, like he'll pass out wide open 3-point shots. He's not actually not a bad 3-point shooter either. He can actually hit some of those shots from out there, but he'll pass them on open shots. And to me, it's a little frustrating. And this whole 2 years has been frustrating in general. I'm gonna give him a D here, man. I have to give him a D.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I'm a huge McRoberts proponent. I really loved his addition there because I thought between him and Luol Deng, they were going to be, you know, in hindsight, it's crazy to even say it, but they were supposed to reproduce a lot of what LeBron James added to this team. You know, the pinpoint passing, the perimeter shooting, the defense along the perimeter, those are the kinds of things that's why they were brought in for. And remember, they were first, or at least McRoberts was first added, knowing that or thinking that LeBron was going to re-sign with the team. So you brought up the injuries. I don't think they were a factor this year, but they can't help but paint how people perceive him, and that's unfortunate. I think he just hasn't fit in here, and I think it's been tough for him. You know, I think that there was pressure from the front office, I think from the overall team to the franchise itself to kind of put a lot of weight on him to see if he could produce, and he didn't get the opportunity. The Rooks got a lot more of chances. When he had his chances, he didn't necessarily capitalize on them. He may be broken at this point. And that's unfortunate because I think he's a good guy. I think he's a solid team player. I think he's a good citizen in the NBA. And I think that that's certainly you always want to have guys like that on your roster. But he just may not be able to contribute moving forward. And it might be better for him to get a fresh start because it just didn't pan out the way he thought it would in Miami. And, you know, he's still going to get his money, I'm sure. It was a decent salary. He chose to come here from Charlotte, you know, even though we were offering him the same amount as the Bobcats at that point were. And, you know, he chose to come to Miami. So maybe he regrets his decision. Maybe he doesn't. It's tough to say for certain. The year was a disappointment, and I'm not sure that he'll get another chance, to be honest with you. The talk has been trading him, you know, for ever since he signed here, basically. You know, ever since the injuries first started building, and he had the support of the front office, but I think that's waned a lot because he just hasn't been productive. To see him pass up open shots against Charlotte or Toronto, it's painful because you know he can knock those down. Maybe that last year in Charlotte was an aberration where he played so effectively. Maybe Steve Clifford just was able to tap in to that potential that had always been there since his days at Duke. I mean, you forget a lot about what we saw such a strong version of him with the Bobcats that last year that you forget that he's played for like seven teams. You know, he was in Indiana, Portland, Orlando. He was all over the place before he finally went to Charlotte and was a real strong factor there. I mean, he was a big part of why that Bobcats team was able to make the playoffs a couple seasons ago. And, you know, it's been a tough adjustment for him here in Miami, and I'm just not sure what his future is, moving forward.
I'm sure with the, obviously the Heat, they're going to have approximately $4 million in cap room. They're going to try to move his contract this summer. That's the worst-kept secret at this point.
I'm still convinced he can be a factor.
Oh, no doubt. And I think I got chastised about this on Twitter the last week. When I said I was being honest, that he actually has been very productive in his last couple of games in the Toronto series because by default because of not having Whiteside, he was very productive on both sides of the ball. And the energy was there. That he could have a place in this team still. And honestly, if thinking bigger picture, $6 million contract will look pretty valuable. Well, actually looks really good, with a rising cap.
Yeah.
So it might be worth him hanging around a little bit because he does provide a lot of skill sets. Now, if he's healthy, obviously the big bugaboo with him is more so he just can't stay healthy. But if he's healthy, I can still see him contributing a good 12 minutes a game and giving some good energy there.
I don't think health was the issue this season, though. I think, he certainly had some problems here and there, but I think he may have had those problems more at the start of the season when they were counting on him to be productive. And then once the second half of the season rolled around, they found they didn't really need him, that they didn't have a place for him. They had Whiteside, they had Stoudemire being, starting and being a solid, starter at that point in time. He didn't. Without a three-point shot, he doesn't space the floor, and he lacked the confidence to just hoist it the way he had in Charlotte. So I think a lot of it more is not physical so much as it is mental, and it's unfortunate to see him get to this point because, he was expected to be a bigger factor. I'm convinced that he still has that potential, but I just don't think that he's going to be able to find a place for in Miami. And, that's unfortunate. Again, we'll talk about this more as we look at free agency. If he's the last straw holding back your ability to sign Whiteside or even another free agent like Kevin Durant or somebody else, that you don't want that to be the case. Clearly they provide more value than McRoberts does at this point. So I think it's a foregone conclusion that they'll try to move him. But I think, you see a guy his size, especially the way smaller lineups are trending, and I think he could still definitely be a factor.
Yeah. You mentioned his name during this topic, Amari Stoudemire. I gave him a B because I thought the minutes he put in most of the year, in the limited minutes put in, he was productive. Especially when he was the starter at the end of the All-Star break, when they decided to go Stoudemire the starter and Whiteside on the bench. I thought he was very productive. He actually had some good moments here. Although he did tail off though in the playoffs, especially in the Toronto series. I just thought Stoudemire overall, at the minimum. I mean, I thought they got what they could out of him, and I think a B is pretty much where he needs to be.
Yeah, I gave him a C, you know, just because he wasn't much of a factor at the start of the year. And even when he was playing at his best, he, you know, far from great, still maybe an unexpected contribution. It's just, you know, it's sad to see a guy who had that kind of unlimited athleticism and explosion when he was with Phoenix. And you know, obviously it's a long, long time ago, but you get hope that maybe you'd see more of that. I think at this point, he's more of a solid veteran role player. I kind of want him to come back and you know, take the veteran minimum again. I could see him, you know, being a factor in Miami. You know, maybe the thing is, I think, you know, he expressed some concerns about not getting enough playing time after the Game 7's loss. And
yeah, what did you think? What did you make of that? Was it, is that over? You think it was overblown? I think it's overblown. I want to hear the entire quote. The entire quote.
You know, I think it was a tough loss. It was a tough series. He saw his minutes get yanked down, you know, yanked around a lot. So he's going to express himself. I think you're right. I think it was overblown, you know, knowing that that locker room and that situation there is a tough one to be put on the spot and to be asked a question like that. And I think, you know, out of context, of course he wants to play more. He's an NBA player. Which NBA player is going to sit there and go, you know what, I'm happy collecting my paycheck and not playing at all. So just giving my minutes to somebody else. Everybody's going to say something along those lines. And I think you're right. Out of context, it sounds like he's pushing the franchise or expressing some concern about Spoelstra. But I think he realizes that at the end of the day, when the cameras and recorders are off, he has to realize that he wasn't productive, that he wasn't playing at a high level. And that's probably why he didn't get more playing time. I think Spoelstra has been fairly honest with all of his players throughout his coaching career that you're going to get minutes if you earn them, and that's all it takes. You know, I think, you know, Udonis accepts it. He's knows his role is to come off the bench to play minutes whenever he's asked to do so. And if it means sitting there for 10, 15 games straight, well, that's what you have to do. I mean, and so it might be difficult for a guy like Stoudemire who's not fully aware of where he is at this point in his career, but I think this might be the beginning of an adjustment period for him to realize that he's not going to get those kinds of minutes moving forward, that he has to welcome whatever chance he gets because he's not going to get very many of them.
Right. Okay, you mentioned you're the king of segues, man. That was good. Udonis Haslem. Udonis Haslem. I thought, you know, he's the captain. He's the leader of this team, you know, obviously in the locker room. And I think for the little he put, the little that he did play, I saw positives, you know, like he's not the same guy. We know that. But I always felt like, especially in the Charlotte series, there were moments when the Heat were down big in game four, when they made a comeback and almost won game four, stole game four to take, but it didn't happen. But had they won that game in a 3-1 series, he was in the game when that run happened. And I noticed a lot of times in both these series against Charlotte and Toronto, that a lot of times when Miami made runs to put the game away, he was a part of that team. He was on the floor at that time. So, obviously he's not the same guy. I gave him a B though because I just think that the leadership, just the stability in the locker room, and just the overall positive energy that he gives to the team, even just in short bursts, is still valuable for the team overall. What do you think?
I agree 100%. I think you know, it's been said before that if you could somehow find a way to take his drive, his energy, his obsession with you know, effort, et cetera, and put that in the incredible athletic body of a Hassan Whiteside, you'd probably get the most dominant player in NBA history. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think, you know, we've seen him struggle. He's aged. He's taken so many hits and bruises over the course of his career. And even though he doesn't play as much as he once did, he still finds a way to try and be productive, even if it's just taking a charge or giving maximum effort. Like the body might not be able to do it, but the mind and the soul are willing, and that's a huge plus. And look, I'm going to go out on record and say I'm completely biased ever since I got a chance to talk to him in the locker room a couple months ago. That completely changed my perspective. I mean, he was just so open and friendly and everything else like that, and it really, really, really changed everything. I mean, the talk had been overblown about him being Mr. 305 and a Heat fixture, but you know, he really feels it, and he really has been a part of the team for such a long time that everything he does from now on, for me anyway, is golden. So I gave him the A+, and knowing that it's probably completely biased, and I don't care, he's earned it.
There was some little speculation that he may have played his last game with the Heat yesterday. Yeah. Because, you know, he said it's still a business and he loved to end his career here, but he knows how things can happen. I still see him come back. I think if he's on the roster, it's on this roster. He'll be on a very, very small contract, but the value of him in his locker room presence, I think is still something that is, I think, appreciated. I mean, even Chris Bosh has alluded many times in the past that, when we're not playing well in the first half and at halftime, you know, UD gets on us and starts cussing in the back, you know, like, he's that guy. He's the emotional leader. And I think there's still value to have those guys in your locker room. And people need to understand that. So I just don't see him playing elsewhere. That's the thing. I don't see him playing another uniform, especially at this point in his career. And I think Riley and Harris are going to make sure they have him here still. I think I just can't see. I see him and Wade retiring at the same time, honestly.
Yeah, I can't see him playing elsewhere either. I think if somehow the team was able to come to the conclusion that they'd rather sign another vet for the same amount of money than to sign Udonis, I just can't see them making that decision. Like they had the money to sign a guy like Stoudemire, but if they had a choice between Stoudemire and Haslam, then they could only take one. I'm pretty sure that they take Haslam. Yeah, absolutely. Even if he's not playing, just because, like you said, the emotional leadership contributions far outweigh whatever he can bring to the court at this point. And he's still able to produce sometimes. You know, the shot's not going to be there. That baseline jumper that we relied on so much during the Big Three era and before that is no longer there. But he's still going to take a charge. He's still going to grab a rebound. He's still going to guard guys that outweigh him by 50, 60 pounds, and he's going to give him maximum effort. So you have to keep a guy like that for as long as he's willing to play.
Right.
As long as he wants to come back, he's got an open contract as far as I'm concerned. They'll find a way to accommodate him somehow.
Okay, this ought to be fun. Gerald Green, the ups and downs. Okay, I'm going to give him a C-minus because I think – okay, he had some moments early in the year. Then he tailed way off middle of the year. I thought defensively in this playoffs, though, that energy-wise, I thought he played his ass off. I thought he really showed effort. In the minutes he brought in the playoffs, I thought he played his ass off. I thought he was as productive as he could be. I mean, obviously, his scoring is hit or miss with him. Like, he can 1 minute score 25 points in the game, and next minute be scoreless and go 0 for 12. But I think Gerald Green, his energy in the playoffs was actually a positive, defensively speaking, especially. But because he's so inconsistent, and it trends more on the negative end of that, I got to give him a C-.
Yeah, you know, I went a little higher because I think it's a matter of perspective and you know, expectation versus reality. And for me, he pretty much stayed true to the player that he had been offensively throughout most of his career. That inconsistency was certainly well established in Phoenix. There were going to be games that he'd shoot you in or out of a game. And you know, that's just the reality with Gerald. I mean, he would get hot. And then when he wasn't, he would still put up shots. And it was just, it's painful to watch through, you know, and that's, you just have to get used to it. But you're right. I think there was some growth defensively and he embraced it. And with the exception of that one incident that went, you know, largely unreported, and we don't know, we'll never likely know the details of what happened. He wasn't a distraction. He accepted his role. He was a gracious cheerleader there when guys had big plays. He was the first guy there wearing the pineapple hair, going crazy, holding everybody back on the sidelines there.
I love that. Fun team to watch. Fun to watch that too, isn't it?
Every dunk or big play, they always pan to that group and they're always freaking out. And you love it. I mean, and they said it. A lot of them, you know, and one of the nicer stories at the end of game seven was everybody talking about what a great locker room it was, that it was the best. And maybe that's hyperbolic. Maybe they don't really mean it. Maybe it's just an exaggeration.
No, I think they do mean it. I think so too. Yeah, I think it's natural. And I think Gerald Green in his and you know, him, you know, not getting minutes but still being positive is an example of the Heat culture we talk about all the time,
right?
And how positive and professional, and you know, like him not falling off the cliff when he could have in November after the incident that went unreported is an example of how strong the culture in Miami is.
I agree.
So I don't know, maybe he's back next year, who knows? I have no idea. He could be. I mean, he's gonna be cheap. So okay, I think it's the last guy here, Tyler Johnson. Missed most of the year, came back for the playoffs. He has a fan club here in Miami. There's a lot of people that love this guy. And I love his energy personally. I gave him a C just because of the, you know, he didn't play much this year because of the injury. Remember they tried my point guard for a little while and that failed miserably? Yeah. I think he's a good player. I think he's still obviously polishing. He has more polishing to do. But overall, it almost more so incomplete in a sense. But his energy is great. But I'll give him a C just because of the fact that he wasn't really available much for the team.
Yeah, I kind of think that, again, expectation versus reality in a guy like him that wasn't necessarily expected to make the team. You never knew what was going to happen with him. And let's be honest with you, he's a pretty small guy. And then for him to be able to bring that kind of explosion and athleticism and, like you said, constant effort and energy, those things really have an impact. There's no doubt that that's why he's as embraced as he has been by Heat fans, because he just doesn't stop. He keeps pushing himself. He finds a way. And there was a time period there, maybe you forgot, though. There was a time period where his shooting was lights out, where he was a real factor from the three-point line. He saved a couple of games. He had a couple 20-point outings. He was a real strong player for Miami during that first half of the season. The injury took a lot of that momentum out. But even still, I mean, even in the games that he did play against Toronto, we saw that effort there. And this was a new backcourt, one that included, you know, a stronger Goran Dragic and a much improved Josh Richardson. And he was still able to find a place for a way to make an impact. And I think that's the kind of, again, seizing that opportunity. Maybe I've regurgitated a little bit too often this podcast, but to me, when you look back at this year and the opportunities that have been presented to the players that are on the roster, he was one of the few that really took advantage of it and made the most of that. And I think you have to reward that. And to me, I think he gets a B plus.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's cool. Darrell Wright. I mean, he won a great Darrell. I mean, he didn't play much. He played, what, one game? If that, two games?
I think he played in two games. And I think there was that one game where he had 8 points in a few minutes. A plus.
There we go. The only A plus in the entire team this year, and he only played two games. Excellent, Darrell Wright. Good job. Before you go, I want to touch on this Chris Bosh story real quick. The report came out today that the Miami Heat suspect that he might be done. Like he may not come. They may not ever clear him. The Heat doctors may not clear him. And people are running the story. You go on social media this morning and all afternoon. People are like, oh, well, you know, it's a big deal. But to me, it's not a big deal because it's really the same. It's really the same status as it was before the release of statement. Because the difference is that now the Heat are out of the playoffs. This is now the only stuff to talk about. And I think now with whoever leaked the story or whatever it may be, now it means something because the season's over. So now you can put out the story like that and that has more traction.
I think they just gave words to something that you and I had expressed for a long time, was that was always a real possibility, was that he would never play again.
Right. And yes, so it's really the same. We're at the same part of the story today on the 16th of May as we were 2 months ago. Really.
Right.
It's a matter now of what direction to go in. Does Bosh retire? Does Bosh? But now, here's what's funny, though. Listen to Levitard this morning, Dan Levitard, that he got a text from somebody in the Heat saying that they expect him to play next year. So we're hearing a lot of things out there. I don't know. Look, Chris Bosh wanted to come and play in this playoff series, in this playoff run. The Heat did not let him. And I think that's being lost here. So at this point, it comes down to what these two parties agree on. Could the NBA doctors as well, the Heat doctors, clear him to play? This is part of the fascination of the Heat's offseason, because a lot of what the Heat's going to do for the next 2-3 years depend on what Chris Bosh's decision is going to be this summer or beyond. So, and no matter what, even if he retires tomorrow or today or next week, his $23 million will be on the books next season no matter what. So it's going to affect the team in the short term right now. Now, long term, we don't know yet. But this story right now is really the same as it has been for a few months now, and we just need to let it be until they decide what's going on.
Yeah, it's again, you're right. I think it just came out at a point in time where people were more willing to accept the news, or, you know, it gets lost because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, if he's going to come back or if he's going to make an appearance in the playoffs. And, you know, you and I had talked about that. Maybe he'd come back at various points during the year, and it never worked out that way. And maybe now that we know that he had wanted to come back, that, you know, that it wasn't necessarily through any fault of his, rather than the organization holding him out for his own safety. And it's probably the wisest decision. You know, he would have come in and disrupt things clearly. I think he would have impacted things negatively for Miami had he come back. I think that's something that a lot of people don't consider, because you want to see him come back and bounce back from this injury and the impact that it's had on him and his health and his family, et cetera. So you want to see him come back, but there's always that chance that he probably would have come back a lesser version of who he was before he got hurt, and he would have impacted Miami's ability to be a good, solid, cohesive unit. So moving forward, you know, if people in the organization are optimistic that he's going to come back and play, that changes things a little bit. I think they've never mentioned that before. I think that Levitard is as plugged in as you're going to get to the Heat front office. And if he's getting that kind of a text on air, knowing that he's going to relay this back to his listening audience, clearly there's hope and optimism there in the Heat front office. So I would expect that he will be back now. I'm changing ground completely, because at first I thought there was no chance that he was going to play. Now it looks like he's more liable to play than ever. And that's, you know, I think he just has to continue working and building. And yes, you're right, it certainly hangs over any decisions they make in the future, and the offseason particularly. So we'll see what happens.
All righty, man. This is a long one today, actually. But hey, look, we have wrapped up the season, you know? And we're going to save the free agency talk and predictions and breakdowns for probably next week's podcast, barring any breaking news, if any, like emergency podcasts got to do. This will be the last podcast to do until next week. By the way, I have Cavs in five. Actually, Cavs in a sweep, possibly five games, and Warriors and Thunder going seven.
Ooh. Wow, that should be a good one, right?
Yeah, buddy. What do you got? Quick. What do you got? Quickly.
I think I've got Warriors in six, and I think I've got Cavs in five.
Okay. Denver Mill, DRamill13 on Twitter. Ernest Christian, EJ Christian 7 on Twitter as well, too. Check out all our work everywhere. Twitter, we are out, guys. God bless. Take care. Later.